Chapter 4. Into a gunfight with a box of tissues. Just hours after Bowen and Bright's twilight text exchange, President Trump, in the afterglow of being acquitted in his first impeachment trial, spoke to a rally of supporters in New Hampshire. He downplayed the virus, comparing it to the seasonal flu, a dangerous and false refrain he and his lieutenants surfaced again and again, saying, "The virus, they're working hard. Looks like by April, you know, in theory, when it gets a little warmer, it miraculously goes away." The day after, Tuesday, February 11th, the World Health Organization coined the name for the disease caused by SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. While Bowen and Bright saw the moment clearly, the inertia of the federal government under Trump steered the nation toward disaster. The weeks and months that followed were like a fever dream, a bad acid trip on a careening bus with no one at the wheel. A wicked soundtrack of newsreels overhead, Trump shouting into the fear centers of our brains. Except it wasn't a hallucination. It was just the news, our national response to an existential threat. And all 330 million Americans were along for the ride. Moments after our invisible enemy was named, the nation's foremost disease expert, speaking at a public forum in Aspen, Colorado, sought to elucidate the virus. He said the risk was relatively low to most Americans, but hedged. "Is there a risk that this is going to turn into a global pandemic?" said Dr. Anthony Fauci. "Absolutely, yes." For more than 35 years, Fauci had served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, under the National Institutes of Health, advising six presidents on everything from HIV/AIDS to Ebola to the disease that had been named just moments before. Fauci knew better than anyone the precarious intersection of public health and politics and public perception. As far as anyone knew, there were only 13 confirmed cases in the United States. So, what if he told the public in this early stage that the virus could bring us to our knees and then nothing happened? "Your credibility is gone," Fauci said of the hypothetical. The next day, the CDC issued guidance that the general public didn't need and shouldn't buy masks, noting, "The virus is not spreading in the community." But in fact, it was. Though the first reported U.S. death would come at the end of February in Seattle, coroners would later find that two people in the San Francisco Bay Area, who had no recent travel history, had died of the disease in the first and second weeks of February. Later examinations would find it was killing Americans in January. There was very little testing, no vaccine, not enough supplies. It was no longer a question of if the country could contain the virus, but how badly the virus would overrun us. It was the doomed strategy Bright had warned against. Meanwhile, HHS leaders continued to stall, telling Navarro and the White House in a February 14th briefing, "There are no known immediate problems with supply chains." Officials at HHS weren't content to just ignore the tsunami before their eyes. They took the additional step of throwing our life rafts to the country that had generated it. Throughout January and February and into early March, the federal government urged mask manufacturers to export hundreds of millions of dollars worth of PPE to China. At the same time, it ignored calls from within to do the opposite. HHS officials, including Cadillac, steered supplies to China as late as February 21st, according to emails ProPublica obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. In Italy, just weeks after a Chinese couple infected with the virus were discovered in Rome, the virus was showing off its ability to spread. The country had closed off travel from China. Yet what started as small clusters of infections had ballooned into nearly 80 confirmed cases in just days. On February 23rd, just after 9 a.m., on the South Lawn of the White House, Trump delivered to reporters a quote that would be his administration's epitaph. We have it very much under control. Trump revealed in a tweet the next day what many news reports would later confirm. His concerns for the virus were indelibly tied to its effect on Wall Street, and by extension, his prospects for the 2020 election. "The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA," the president tweeted. "We are in contact with everyone in all relevant countries. CDC and World Health have been working hard and very smart. Stock market starting to look very good to me." In private, Trump would later tell journalist Bob Woodward that he intentionally downplayed the virus's threat to avoid a panic. The administration's upbeat messaging was cooled the next day by comments from Dr. Nancy Messonnier, the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, housed under the CDC. She warned that many Americans would become sick and that disruption to everyday life may be severe. "We expect we will see community spread in this country," she said. On warnings from a top CDC official that schools might close and businesses might move to remote work, the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 879 points, and the S&P 500 dropped 3%. In four trading days, U.S. stocks, on the whole, lost some $2.1 trillion in value. It was now official. The virus was the biggest economic and political challenge Trump would ever face. The next day, February 26th, Trump announced he was replacing HHS Secretary Azar with Vice President Mike Pence as the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. To some, the move conveyed that locking the virus down was a top priority for the administration. To others, it signaled that politics was guiding the way. The national supply strategy was at this point a glorified public relations campaign. HHS and the CDC attempted to use media coverage and its platforms to urge civilians not to buy or hoard masks. As Bright predicted, the message produced the opposite effect. Panic buying was in full swing, and price gouging followed. By February 27th, a 10-pack of the gold standard 3M N95 respirators that sold on Amazon.com for about $18 was going for $100. HHS Secretary Azar told the House Ways and Means Committee on February 27th that COVID-19 will look and feel to the American people more like a severe flu season in terms of the interventions and approaches you will see. But both Trump and his cabinet knew better. As March neared, the evidence that HHS had botched the messaging and wasted critical weeks was mounting. On February 29th, Washington State announced the first known death from COVID-19 in the United States. Though it was not truly the first, officials there were seeing community spread, including in nursing homes, and signs of larger outbreaks to come. That day, Washington State health officials requested 200,000 N95s, 200,000 surgical masks, 5,000 face shields, 64,000 pairs of gloves, and 60,000 disposable gowns from the stockpile. Based on what HHS said were Washington State's actual needs, the federal government instead released 100,000 N95s, 100,000 surgical masks, 2,565 face shields, 32,000 pairs of gloves, and 30,000 disposable gowns. Conveniently, likely arbitrarily, half the amount of each item requested. Officials overseeing the stockpile were already safeguarding precious inventory and were, in essence, winging it. Pence, now overseeing the White House Coronavirus Task Force, said in a press conference that day that the federal government was working with 3M to speed up production of N95s by tens of millions more a month. As Bowen knew, that was no easy task. Much of the company's mask supply came from China. And even if U.S. production ramped up as it had during World War II, the materials needed to make masks were now dependent on suppliers in Asia and Mexico. On that eventful last night of February 2020, Cadleck read through a scientific analysis published by Chinese scientists titled, "The Epidemiological Characteristics of an Outbreak of 2019 Novel Coronavirus Diseases in China." It provided some of the first scientifically rigorous conclusions and was a harbinger of the devastation to come. The study examined more than 72,000 COVID-19 cases to track the virus's toll on humans and its spread across mainland China in just 1 month. The early data found an overall case fatality rate of more than 2%, though it was much higher for patients with pre-existing conditions like heart disease and diabetes. For people over the age of 80, the fatality rate was near 15%. The data was early, and estimates would change, but the baseline trend was horrific. In comparison, infectious disease experts estimate that seasonal flu's overall mortality rate is typically less than 0.1%. This was nothing like the flu. However dismissive he'd been of Bright, Cadleck now seemed to grasp the urgency. Just past 10 p.m. on Saturday, February 29th, in an email to several top HHS officials, including Bright, Cadleck wrote, "Having reviewed this, I feel we are going into a gunfight with a box of Kleenex tissues." On March 3rd, Cadleck and other high-ranking officials took questions from the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, often referred to as the HELP Committee. As of that morning, there were more than 100 confirmed COVID-19 cases in the United States. The devastation overseas was much worse, causing supply chain disruptions and widespread economic concerns. Speaking as the ranking member for the minority, Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, where 9 people and counting had died of the disease, provided a stark assessment. In her state, cases were climbing. People who wanted to get tested could not, and those who could were waiting weeks for results. As of that morning, the Life Care Center nursing home in Kirkland, a Seattle suburb, was the epicenter of the U.S. outbreak, with 7 patients dead and another 50 residents and staff showing symptoms. "While I am profoundly grateful for the work public health officials are doing," Murray said, "I am very frustrated at the steps the president has taken, from repeatedly contradicting experts' advice to downplaying the seriousness of this threat, and to appointing a politician to lead the response," referring to Pence. In their questions, Democrats expressed frustration with Trump's leadership and worry that the administration's persistent attacks on the Affordable Care Act might affect the delivery of health services to populations most vulnerable, such as nursing home patients and people in low-wage, essential jobs. Republican senators, in turn, emphasized calm and reiterated that the risk to the public was, as the scientists had said, still relatively low. But 2 of the Republicans asking questions that day had already put their money where their mouths weren't. One was Richard Burr, a Republican from North Carolina. Burr was something of a pandemic expert, having helped pass the seminal Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, signed into law in 2006 by then-President George W. Bush. The act made sweeping changes to the HHS bureaucracy, with a mind toward national security. It was also that legislation that created both BARDA and ASPR. Burr had helped create both Bright's and Cadleck's jobs. The guy knew his stuff, and he reminded his colleagues as much as he asked a few mild questions about funding and the lag in testing. Burr also happened to be chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, a powerful post which afforded him access to classified information about national security. Long before the public knew much at all about the virus, his committee had received daily briefings on its attributes and its advance toward the United States. From this perch, he had made public assurances that the pandemic response apparatus he'd helped build was ready. But Burr had sold off as much as $1.7 million of his stock portfolio in mid-February, just after senators received a classified briefing on the coronavirus, and just before the market began to collapse on February 24th. Those holdings would have lost about 30% of their value by the time Robert Facciarecci, a ProPublica colleague of mine, broke the story in late March. An investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission would later reveal that Burr's brother-in-law also sold off stocks, just minutes after the two talked by phone. On February 27th, just 5 days before the hearing, Burr shared grave concerns with a VIP group during a luncheon at the Capitol Hill Club. According to a secret recording obtained by NPR, Burr told that group, "There's one thing that I can tell you about this. It is much more aggressive in its transmission than anything that we have seen in recent history. It is probably more akin to the 1918 pandemic." About an hour after Burr spoke at the March 3rd Help Committee, its newest Republican member, Senator Kelly Loeffler of Georgia, asked softball questions about how HHS would work hand in glove with the private sector to develop drugs and vaccines. She and her husband, who also happened to be chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, sold off more than $1.8 million in holdings just before the market slide pummeled most Americans' 401ks. Financial records show other senators traded and cashed in stock at curious times. Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma sold off hundreds of thousands of dollars in stock, avoiding steep losses. Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, sold between $1.5 million and $6 million in those crucial weeks. Senator David Perdue of Georgia timed his trades impeccably, selling between $1 million and $5 million he held in a financial technology company just before the market dipped, and buying much of that stock back at a deep discount weeks later in March. All the legislators would deny wrongdoing, some blaming money managers and pre-planned trades. The Justice Department investigated these transactions to see if members of Congress were benefiting from knowledge the public did not yet have. But no charges were brought before the case was closed. Toward the end of the hearing, questions from Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, provided the news hook. "Given the fact that our medical professionals need masks, gowns, gloves, and so forth," Romney began, "if we were to have a full-blown pandemic, and I hope we don't, but if we have one, what percentage of what we would need for our medical professionals is in the strategic national stockpile?" 10% of what we need right now," Cadillac told the senator. "It strikes me that we should have substantially more than 10% than what would be needed for a substantial pandemic," Romney responded. "I can't believe we don't have that in stock." 10% of what we needed. For a pandemic that many experts believed was now inevitable. It was startling enough for headlines. But it was also wrong, in the worst way. The day after the hearing, Cadillac corrected his comments. The country had closer to just 12 million N95s, and 30 million of the far less protective surgical masks. So, in fact, the United States had on hand just 1% of what we needed for the coming onslaught. A day after the hearing, the Commerce Department stopped helping U.S. companies sell masks to China. 2 days later, officials from Massachusetts wrote to Cadillac and requested 750,000 N95 masks, 750,000 surgical masks, 750,000 gloves, 750,000 surgical gowns, and more. On March 6th, according to HHS emails, Honeywell began a bid to secure an 18-month contract to produce 100 million N95 respirators, a timeline and a quantity that sounded big, but was a small fraction of what would be needed in the months ahead. On March 9th, many weeks after Bright and Bowen and others had sounded the alarm on the looming mask shortage, Cadillac's office sought a meeting with the CEO of 3M to get more masks flowing into the stockpile, according to emails obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. On March 11th, the WHO made it official. COVID-19 was a global pandemic. That same day, responding to an outbreak in New Orleans, officials in Louisiana requested tens of thousands of respirators, masks, face shields, and gowns. Oregon requested 400,000 N95s and 600,000 surgical masks. And the requests kept coming. Officials in North Carolina, seeing little help from the federal government, reached out to the home improvement chain Lowe's, which is headquartered there, to see about buying every mask the company had. The masks were already gone. After failing to heed warnings and stockpile masks and other gear, Cadillac and others within HHS were desperate and began personally entertaining solicitations from supposed middlemen who claimed to have access to masks, including people who'd never sold to any government and had no experience in medical supply. In one telling example, according to his emails, Cadillac entertained a solicitation from someone claiming to be a retired NBA Hall of Fame basketball player. The solicitation was riddled with bizarre typos, factual errors, incoherent strings, and multiple fonts, presumably from cutting and pasting passages from various websites. The firm claimed it could deliver 14 million 3M N95 respirators, more than the 12 million the entire U.S. government had on hand. The email should have aroused skepticism. Yet Cadillac set up a 7 p.m. conference call for March 11th, according to HHS emails. It's unclear what occurred during that call, if it happened at all. But this is what the top leaders of the pandemic response were doing with their time. On March 13th, Trump declared a national emergency, and when asked about his administration's failure to roll out widespread testing, said, "I don't take responsibility at all." The next day, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, running the largest hospital network in the country, reached out to the stockpile, saying it had immediate need of 200 million N95s. VA officials estimated they'd be out of masks by the end of the week.